So good afternoon. I'm here to talk about a partnership for culturally competent obstetrical care that we've developed in Baltimore, Maryland. And my co-presenters who are not here include Adrian Attlee and Corrine Noncom from the IRC in Baltimore and Rosemary Riel from the School of Nursing, Office of Global Health at University of Maryland, where I'm also a professor, assistant professor. I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. This is an outline of what I'm going to present. I'm going to talk about the issue of refugee resettlement and the work that we've done to develop health fact sheets for improving obstetrical care for four refugee groups, some of the key cultural issues that we've found in our work, and recommendations for strengthening culturally competent care for refugee families, and then tell you what our next steps are, because we're not at all finished, and we have a lot of exciting things, I think, to look forward to. So if Adrian Attlee were here from the IRC, she would talk to you about who is a refugee. And this is the definition of refugees, a person who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable to, or owing to such fear, unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. So there have been many refugees fleeing conflict and persecution, and these are just a few of those places. The refugees in Baltimore that we have been working with include those from Bhutan, from Burma, from Eritrea, and from Iraq. But there certainly are other groups as well. So in terms of the refugee resettlement process, I think it's very interesting to know sort of a big picture scope of this problem. In 2011, 10.4 million people in the world were refugees, plus 4.7 million living in refugee camps in the Middle East. Two-thirds of the refugees are from Asia and Africa. However, only 0.5% to 1% of refugees become resettled, so a relatively small percentage and number. The process of resettlement includes registration with the United Nations High Commission on Refugees, referral to a resettlement country, the U.S. is accepting about half of those that are resettled, and then the process begins overseas by the Refugee Support Center. It's managed by the United States Department of State Bureau of Populations. There are interviews that take place wherever the refugee camps are. Security clearance is obtained through the Department of Homeland Security. There's overseas medical screening by the International Organization for Migration. And then, once all these steps are taken, the individuals are matched with voluntary resettlement agencies like the IRC. So it could be a long process, and people are often in camps for years before they're resettled in the United States. Again, this is just a snapshot, and I can't pretend to tell you that I understand a lot about this. This is the business of the IRC. But once a refugee is resettled, they are sent to a place in the United States, such as Baltimore. They're met at the airport. They're taken to a new home that's fully outfitted and furnished. They're provided with clothing and food, and then they're provided with case management, focusing on these kind of areas to help them develop a new life in the United States. So all these things are very important for families and individuals to become capable of caring for themselves and developing their new life here. The IRC resettles about 11,000 people annually in the United States, and we have about 1,500 a year resettling in Maryland. So it's a pretty big group. IRC is a nonprofit organization that responds to humanitarian crises. They are in over 40 countries, 22 U.S. cities, including Baltimore. They were founded in 1933 at the request of Albert Einstein and do offer life-saving care and life-changing assistance to refugees forced to flee from war or disaster. So that is a little bit about the IRC, our partner in this work. In Baltimore, there are, and many other regional offices, they're helping refugees rebuild their lives, and they have these many programs to address the needs of refugees once they come to the United States. So we've been engaged in several pieces of that work. The special needs and medically vulnerable issues for refugees include these, and I note the issue of pregnancy, and that's what we have focused on in our work together. This is just a little map and a picture of some of the people from Bhutan that are being resettled in Baltimore, and you can see it's very close to Nepal, Mount Everest, and Bangladesh, and these are people in their in the camps, sometimes they're in Nepal, camps in Nepal rather than in Bhutan. In Burma, you can see again the location and the family from Burma, such as the families that are being resettled. Eritrea, its location between Sudan and Ethiopia, right next to the Red Sea. Again, a picture of the nationality group. And in Iraq, again, we know a lot about Iraq because of the war, but Middle East families, many of them in shelters. So how did we develop this work with IRC and with the refugee population? We've had a total of about 24 students so far involved in the work from University of Maryland, and we started our partnership with a community public health practicum for CNL students, our entry-level master's program for students that already have a bachelor's degree. We're working with an early head start, and the director talked to us about Somali Bantu women and families who had had very, they ended up okay, but pregnancy outcomes that concerned them. The women had had female genital mutilation, and they had been told by their care providers they were going to have a cesarean section. One of the women had already delivered vaginally in Somalia and didn't understand why she had to have a cesarean section. And the women were so concerned about this that they stopped going to their prenatal visits. And then they waited until it was almost too late. The one woman had a footling breach, and they were very concerned about that child. The other one had meconium staining and had just not had adequate prenatal care. So the director of the Head Start where we were working asked us to see what we could do about the problem. So we did a lot of research in the peer-reviewed literature, went to online provider networks, met with key informants, including the IRC and the women and the families, and successfully found a place where the women, we thought, could an alternative place where they could deliver that had the lowest cesarean section rate in the state of Maryland, and we linked families to that site, which is Maryland General, and had them go and view the options available there and meet the care providers. It's all midwives, almost all women providers, which was another issue that they were very concerned about because they're also Muslim. So we were able to link several newly pregnant women to care through this mechanism. That fall, we started a formal and active partnership with the IRC, the fall of 2010, researching cultural issues for obstetrical care for women from Bhutan and Burma. So we did peer review literature search. We also developed focus group questionnaire to identify the women's concerns. IRC convened focus groups and found us an interpreter for the groups, and we met with the two groups and then did a summary of issues from both the peer-reviewed literature and the focus group, which brought different issues out that we hadn't anticipated. Then in the following spring, we worked with their special care needs program across groups, so we were not focusing explicitly on pregnancy, but we were still working in conjunction with them. And then in the summer, we have a global health program that has field experience, and we had a PhD and an MS student working with the Burmese and Bhutanese families. And what they did was they made home visits to pregnant and newly delivered women. They talked to them about their experience, their concerns, and they began to put this information together into fact sheets that we could then use to identify issues of cultural significance to them that we could use with healthcare providers. And then the fall of 2011, we had another clinical group with CNL students that used the same methodology of doing research, conducting focus groups, and developing fact sheets to summarize the cultural issues, this time looking at Eritrean and Iraqi families. So we've now actually covered four nationality groups, five if we include the Somali Bantu, but four that have been done with this same process. We're in the process of finalizing the fact sheets. The one for Bhutanese is almost completely finalized. We've had one more meeting with the Bhutanese community to review these issues and vet the ideas. So our next steps are to continue the vetting with each of the communities, and we've begun scheduling meetings with healthcare provider organizations in Baltimore. The IRC expects to fully approve the fact sheets, and that will be with their national office, and we're hoping that they'll be made available online so that they can be used not just in Baltimore but other places, because there are 22 sites where the IRC is receiving refugees at this point. So our goals of the project were to identify these traditional practices that impact labor and delivery, and then to increase cultural awareness among healthcare providers and improve cultural competency provided by our healthcare system. So we will have the fact sheets, and we're developing an advocacy training presentation. It will be joint with School of Nursing personnel and the IRC to healthcare providers around different nationality groups. So the students had identified this model, this framework for audience, channel, and messaging. And you can see here sort of our formative work, our process work, the audience that we've identified, the channel that we're going to take this message of increasing cultural awareness and competence. And we expect to do evaluations both with the community of women in community focus groups again and with provider feedback on the presentations. And we certainly hope to be able to show that the fact sheets are indeed useful. So just to let you know, our providers in Baltimore include primary care providers, the Baltimore Medical System, which is a federally qualified healthcare center, and four maternity hospitals that have been seeing refugees and delivering babies. The key cultural issues that we have found are quite broad and include, of course, the issue of language barriers and not having someone speak your language, having social support or more likely lack of it, the gender of healthcare provider, which throughout the four cultures we've looked at, most women prefer to have women providers. Food and beverages, which has come up to be a very large issue, one that I think the healthcare system can do something about, that we had not previously really identified. The issue of C-sections, which I think is well known, but the cultural issues as it impacts the communities are not well known. Pain management, birth control, the consenting process at hospitals and the unfamiliarity with the medical system, religious considerations, and of course transportation. And transportation issues being so profound as if they call 911 because they panic that because they're in labor, they are not going to go to the hospital of their choice. They're going to go to the nearest hospital. And it might totally negate work that was done with them to try to find a good place for them to deliver. So these are some of the sample issues and messages for the Bhutanese culture that we have identified. I've mentioned gender, the family presence during labor and delivery. Typically it's women, grandmother, mother, sister, female relative. The presence of the husband is a personal preference based on them being in the United States, not by how they would normally do it. So again, issues that I think are important that healthcare providers know that we think it's great to have the husband there at birth. Some cultures, this has not been a practice. So it needs to be, the families need to be asked if they would like that. Decision-making, husbands generally are considered head of household in this culture, but most decisions about pregnancy, childbirth, reproductive health are either made independently or jointly. So it's important to include the husband in some of the decision-making, and sometimes that isn't done. On the issue of food, I'm going to skip to there, before and during labor, and this is true for the four cultures, women traditionally consume warm and spicy soups, hot water, and hot milk. Now, this is not at all the ice chips or the cold food and beverages that are given during labor, which this culture believes will induce colds, fevers, and headaches. So it's really important for healthcare providers to know, you know, that the kinds of things that are offered are going to be perceived in a very different way. So I think the whole issue, too, of eating and drinking during labor is something we need to think more about, because if women aren't going to have surgical births, then it certainly may make more sense for encouraging breastfeeding that they drink and are more hydrated during labor. So I can't answer that, but we think it's really important to make these considerations during that period of time. Same with communications, and there are a lot of women may not feel comfortable asking questions or expressing opinions, so we feel it's important to ask open-ended questions and encourage women to voice their thoughts and opinions. And there are issues also on family planning. So we sort of divided our recommendations up into two sets, one for providers and one for institutional-based decisions. So on the C-section issue, many of these cultures intend to have a number of children, four children, six children, not uncommon. So having a C-section has huge implications in terms of their family. And communication about why the woman needs a C-section and the care needed afterwards is very, very important. Often women feel that every woman we talked to said if they needed it, they would have it. There was no question about if they need it, but it had never been fully communicated why they needed a C-section. So even several years after the birth, they were wondering, did I really need that? And it had, again, we don't do a good job of communicating that, and nor do healthcare providers understand the cultural implications of having a C-section when you might not be able to have the number of children you had hoped to have that was part of your culture. The issues of communication, the open-ended questions, are one. The other is to try to have a female interpreter, including a female telephone interpreter. These women do not like having male interpreters, and it's much better to have someone there in person if that is possible, which the IRC does try to facilitate in Baltimore. The telephone is very difficult, especially when there are different dialects, and you may have somebody who comes from the country but speaks a different dialect, making it very difficult to communicate with them. The women also need to have discussions about family planning options in depth before and after the birth, including interpreters if necessary, and they need to be offered contraception before they leave the hospital, and if possible, include the father in these discussions. On the institutional-based care decision, I think the issue of gender is a difficult one, although some hospitals are more than capable of providing female health care providers for the delivery, particularly nurses, but also doctors or midwives. The attendance during labor and delivery, I think, can be handled well by inviting them to have female family members there, making sure they know that that's policy. Most of the hospitals we talked to, all the hospitals said that they would be happy to have up to four people, but that may not be communicated to the women in advance. The issue of food was striking because some women told us they left the hospital after delivering a child hungry. They did not get enough food. They were not offered the kind of foods that they would normally eat. They couldn't read the menu. They had no idea what was on the menu. And they didn't have rice. They said, you eat bread, we eat rice. There was no rice. So I think very simple kinds of changes could be made in terms of having a menu with pictures of menu items so they could pick menu items easily, ask certainly about religious preferences, and offer rice, and offer have a supply of sauces that could be used to which you could add vegetables that would be palatable for many cultures. And then, of course, allowing family members to bring in special foods, not that they have to secretly bring them in, but making that a real upfront kind of offering of the hospital. So I think this food issue actually could be resolved quite satisfactorily and fairly easily. So our next steps are to finish development of the fact sheets, check the accuracy, get the approval. We're planning the advocacy presentations. We have one scheduled for November, and we're hoping to have one scheduled for December, and then to begin to evaluate utility and the work of the advocacy presentation. So we wanted to thank the IRC Baltimore Public Health Program staff, the refugee and asylee families. These are the Bhutanese, some of the Bhutanese women and their children who participated in our focus group this fall when we were vetting some of these issues for the second time. Our students from the University of Maryland School of Nursing, and these particular students that have been involved in the majority of the work in this culturally competent care. That's it.